Where does human dignity come from? Who determines what's right and wrong? And can any society exist without a shared moral compass? Welcome to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson. And today's guest is Dr. Robert P. George, who will help us tackle these important questions. Now, Professor George is the McCormick Professor of Jurisprudence at Princeton University and the director of the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. Dr. George is highly regarded for his work in moral philosophy, constitutional law, and natural law theory. He served on the U.S. Commissions on Civil Rights and Religious Freedom. He's also the author of a book released earlier this year called Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. Dr. George, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Richard. Thank you.
Hey, it's really our privilege and honor to have you join us to talk about your book, of course, and a lot of the important things that you tackle in here. And I want to go to maybe one of the most important questions for any human being. It's an important question for me in the Commonwealth Policy Center, and it's the question of the sanctity of human life. Why is human life so important and sacred and intrinsically valuable? And you have this beautiful chapter called Human Embryos Are Human Beings. You shared a principle and a logical defense of human life at its earliest stage. Now, here's where I want to go with this, a little bit different direction. One of the big debates in the public arena is over IVF, or in vitro fertilization. There are many conservatives who see IVF as a good for those couples who cannot naturally conceive. But there's a conundrum here because it involves the creation of an excess of tiny human embryos. It involves warehousing them and then ends in their inevitable destruction. And this issue has divided the pro-life community. Can you speak to a principled pro-life perspective when it comes to IVF?
Well, there is a lot there. Perhaps, Richard, I could begin just by saying a word about why I put this book together. The book consists of essays that I've written over the past 10 or 12 years. The purpose of the book really is to share with the broader public ideas and arguments that I have been working on in my scholarship and sharing with my students here at Princeton over that expanse of time, addressing many of the most controversial and timely issues of our day, including the status of the human embryo, the nature of marriage, issues of religious freedom and the rights of conscience, and on and on. This book, unlike some of my other books, I should say, is not written for my fellow scholars. It's not written for professors. It's not highly technical. It doesn't go into the weeds on a lot of issues. It's written for ordinary people. Again, drawing on my experience teaching 18 to 22-year-old undergraduates here at Princeton, I wrote the book so that it would be accessible to, for example, high school seniors and college freshmen. I'd love everybody to read it, people of all ages and all walks of life, but I think it is particularly valuable. I hope it will be particularly valuable to young men and women. And it's a road-tested message. I've tested it on my students over the past, as I say, a decade or so, and worked things out using them as my guinea pigs. Now, you've asked specifically about the question of IVF, and of course that does implicate, as you yourself noted, the question of the moral status of human embryos. And that's because human beings come into being, whether it is by natural reproduction, by sexual intercourse, or by technical means in laboratories, come into being as embryos. There's a moment before, there's a time before we exist, and there's a time that we come into existence. And there is no scientific mystery, contrary to what some ill-informed people say, there is no scientific mystery as to when that time is. We shouldn't put up with people anymore who say, oh gosh, we don't know when life begins, or it's a speculative question, or it's a theological question, or it's a metaphysical question. No, it's a matter of scientific fact, now well-established and long-determined. Human life begins at the point at which we have a new human embryo. Yeah. In ordinary sexual intercourse, that occurs with the fertilization of the female gamete, the ovum, by the male gamete, the sperm. When other means are used, it's when the embryo is formed by that means. Mm-hmm. Now, you're absolutely right, of course, that many couples, many good people suffer from infertility, and it's genuine suffering. People who long to have children, it's very natural and very human and very good mm-hmm. to long to have children. Many people who long to have children can't, by ordinary marital intercourse, have children. So the question is, what are we going to do for them? Now, of course, historically, we had adoption. And of course, that is still a wonderful alternative. There are children who need a mom and a dad, including mm-hmm. very young children, who would be blessed to have as their parents the kinds of good people who are, in so many cases, suffering from infertility. But modern technology has made available other means, in vitro fertilization. In vitro simply means that the fertilization takes place not by ordinary sexual intercourse, but in a laboratory yeah. where the sperm and egg are united, and then the tiny embryo is created, just as it would be in ordinary sexual intercourse, and then implanted in the prepared uterus of the woman, mm-hmm. Of the mother, or, of course, in some cases, there is now surrogate motherhood. Now, I have a basic problem with the whole procedure because of the way in which it tends to objectify mm-hmm. the new human being, the developing child, mm-hmm. turn that child into a product of manufacture rather than as a gift that supervenes on the marital love mm-hmm. as expressed in sexual intercourse of husband and wife. And I worry about the way our attitudes are shaped mm. when we turn procreation into a species of manufacture. Very quickly, and we have seen this wherever in vitro fertilization has been introduced, very quickly, people begin to think of the child as a product, mm. as a product, and therefore mm-hmm. subject to quality controls yep. like any other product. And that means when the child conceived is not good enough, then it's got to be discarded, cast aside, destroyed, so that we can get a better version of the product. This is an inhumane attitude toward human beings, precisely because human beings are bearers of profound, inherent, and equal dignity. From a Christian point of view or a Jewish point of view, from a biblical point of view, the rootedness of that principle is in the concept of the Imago Dei, yep. the concept that man is made in the very image and likeness of his creator, the very image and likeness of God, a message we get at the very earliest point yeah. in our scripture, in yep. the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis. But Richard, even if we were to lay aside that fundamental moral concern I have about transforming procreation into a species of manufacture and adopting this attitude toward the child in his very coming to be as a product, we still have a profound moral problem with in vitro fertilization, at least as it's practiced here in the United States. We produce many, many, many more embryos yeah. than can be or will need to be implanted in those, in women who are seeking the cure, the overcoming of their infertility problem. Those embryos then are either discarded, destroyed, or they're put in permanent freezing, what's called cryopreservation. Now, they may later be implanted, but not necessarily, and most actually won't. They may be rescued. There may be a couple who know about embryos that are in cryopreservation that will not be implanted. This means the destruction, functionally, yeah. means the destruction of many, many human lives. And that's exactly what they are. Yeah. Because an embryo is not something, Richard, different from a human being. It's not something that will later become a human being. Yeah. An embryo is a human being at a certain very early developmental stage. Embryos, fetuses, infants, children, adolescents aren't different kinds of things. So when they discard or cryopreserve this huge number of embryos in vitro fertilization, those are human beings whose lives are being treated in that way as, for example, disposable material or frozen away with no prospect of actually developing. So these are the issues that should give us profound moral reservations about going forward this way. The way we should be treating infertility is by treating the underlying causes of fertility. Yeah. Funding that is going heavily into in vitro research today should be going into research that will enable couples to have children by natural means. The way you direct money, and so I learned this when I was serving on the President's Council on Bioethics, the way you direct money in science will depend on moral decisions that you make. If you make one moral decision, the money's going to go down one path. If you make another one, it's going to go down another path.
Yeah. Dr. George, thank you for that, by the way. This is, I think, one of the great questions of our day is the protection of human life. And one of the chapters in your book, you talk about Christianity and the rise of paganism, and you say that Christianity has contributed largely to a sanctity of human life ethic where the most vulnerable have been protected in law, whereas in pagan societies, they haven't been. It's those who are most powerful and strong without regard to the weak. In fact, the weak were not cared for, entirely discarded.
Discarded, as we're doing to in vitro embryos today.
I want to pivot over to the end of life's journey. We talked about the very beginning, the embryonic stage. Well, let's talk about the end of life, terminally ill people. This is another big public policy question. As we record the program today, one of the headlines in national news was that New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced a deal with legislative leaders that she will sign the Medical Aid in Dying Act, which essentially is physician-assisted suicide. Now, you have a chapter in your book entitled Death with Dignity, a Dangerous Euphemism. Speak to that. Why is that a dangerous euphemism?
Well, I'll be happy to do that. And I'm very sorry to learn that Governor Kathy Hochul of New York, following now just a few days earlier, Governor Pritzker of Illinois, has decided to sign, in both cases, bills that that legalize so-called medical assistance in dying. There's nothing medical about it. Yeah. This is killing people.
Yeah.
It's killing people ostensibly to prevent them from horrible suffering and so forth. But we've seen this legislation time and again. We see that it, quote, evolves, unquote. It begins by saying, well, you can only kill people who are severely physically suffering and have a very, very short time to live. They have a terminal diagnosis. And then you go down the slippery slope, and it's no time, literally no time, before you're killing 13-year-old girls who are suffering from nothing more than psychological depression, not to make light of psychological depression. But the whole justification was this intense physical suffering. You stop treating the person by dealing with the problem, and you start solving the problem by killing the person. And this is a bad step. My beloved great friend, the great scholar, the great bioethicist, Leon Cass, it makes the point time and time again, medicine is not in the business of killing people. It's in the business of healing people and caring for people. Once it goes down the road to killing, it's no longer medicine. It's compromised. It's fundamental justification. It's fundamental reason for being. It converts the healer into the killer, the facilitation, the facilitator of killing. It has a profound impact on the psychology of those in the medical field and a profound impact on the public. People who get older, they become disabled, they become dependent on others, will start to perceive themselves, they already do, but it will make it much worse, perceive themselves as burdens, right, as burdens, who think, I should get out of the way. I'm drawing down family resources. I'm too much of a burden on my family psychologically. I don't want my children to have to, or my grandchildren to have to have to care for me. It'd be better if I just died.
Yeah.
When we change the law, we change cultural attitudes. The book on the basis of which I got tenure at Princeton and back in the Middle Ages, back in 1993, my book, Making Men Moral, made a simple point, but it's such a profoundly true one. And that is that law shapes culture and culture shapes conduct. Law shapes culture and culture shapes conduct. Now, law is also in turn shaped by culture, but law reciprocally shapes culture. When we change the law the way these governors are now doing, we're going to change people's understandings, that framework of expectations and understandings that people bear with them through their lives. It's not going to just make this new so-called good, which I think is really a bad, assisted suicide, available to people who would otherwise want it. It's going to affect whether they want it. It's going to affect people's desires for it, their sense of whether this is a good thing to do or a bad thing to do. We're going down a very, very dangerous road here. And this takes us back, Richard, to that principle in the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible, in the book of Genesis, of the Imago Dei, the principle that is our anchor for the idea that the human being is a bearer of profound, inherent, and equal dignity. That principle on the basis of which we struggled and finally succeeded in eliminating slavery, although it still exists in some places in the world and in certain respects, even in our own country. But we made certainly enormous progress. We eliminated de jure slavery. We fought on the basis of that principle. Martin Luther King fought on the basis of that principle to undo the injustice of Jim Crow and segregation. So much good has been done in the name of that principle. I hate to now see it abandoned. But you made a point a moment ago that I want to emphasize. You know, for the ancient world, for the pagan world, that Jewish idea, that Jewish insight, that Jewish revelation that man is made in the image and likeness of God was a profound outlier. For most of humanity, if a person became a burden, kill him. Or help him to kill himself, encourage him to kill himself, get rid of them because they're a burden. They lack the very idea of intrinsic and equal human dignity that was given to us by that great biblical insight in the Hebrew Bible at the very beginning. We mustn't throw it away, Richard. That is going back to a place that will be a very dark and inhuman place for human beings to live. So I think we have to push back. We can't, I mean, the Democratic Party now seems to have been lost on this issue, embracing abortion through the entire 9 months of pregnancy, now physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. I'd love to win the Democratic Party back. When I was a boy, my family were Democrats. I was a Democrat. I had to leave that behind precisely because the party betrayed its fundamental moral convictions. But if the Democrats are going to go down this road, we have to at least keep the old faith alive, the old moral commitment alive in the Republican Party. And I worry about it eroding there. We cannot take this lying down. We cannot take it as a given that we're now going to have assisted suicide across the United States. There's too much at stake. Human life is too precious. That principle of inherent and equal human dignity has to be held to and defended.
Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you.
I couldn't agree with you more. That is well said. I want to pivot from that topic of the book chapter on the euphemism of that's there with assisted suicide. one of the euphemism related to that is death with dignity or compassion in dying. And I'm going to speak in a larger context of the political left using moral terminology to advance their issues. I'm going to give a few other examples. Marriage equality, fairness, reproductive rights, the dignity of LGBTQ people. And the reason I want to press into this is because it's been said that he who defines the terms wins the debate. Now, I find it fascinating, Dr. George, that the political left generally appeals to some kind of a higher standard or reaching for a moral high ground, while at the same time generally rejecting the idea of a creator who has instituted a higher standard. And here's my question. What would you recommend to conservative Christians who are engaging these issues in the public arena, specifically when they hear terminology of death with dignity, of compassion in dying, marriage equality? What would you recommend to them? And I'll go to debates that you've had with Cornel West. He's one of your colleagues. He's the polar opposite on many of these moral and social issues. But the reason I bring him into the discussion is because I think you have done a very fine job of engaging the opposition with intellectual rigor and with grace and with care, truly trying to understand what are they promoting and what are they saying. And that's been a benefit to everybody who listens to these debates. What could we take away, just the average person who's not going to be debating another academic, but how does the average person around the water cooler at their workplace or maybe in their neighborhood talking to neighbors about these issues, how do they begin to maybe address some of these the terms that the left has co-opted to use to further their political agenda?
It's very interesting. In the early days of social liberalism, at the beginning, for example, of the sexual revolution in the 1940s and 50s, the modern sexual revolution. Of course, once you start tracing these things back, you can quickly end up in the Garden of Eden. But we know that there was some decisive movement forward for the sexual revolution in the 1940s with Alfred Kinsey's, turns out to be entirely phony, so-called scientific studies of human sexuality, with the mainstreaming of pornography by Hugh Hefner with his Playboy magazine, and then the rise of the counterculture in the 1960s and the free love movement and so forth. In those days, defenders of social liberalism would appeal to moral relativism or subjectivism, the idea that there is no such thing as moral truth. And then they fallaciously drew from that false premise the inference that people should therefore be able to do whatever they want, so long as they don't harm others or violate the rights of others. But the left quickly learned that that was not a product that the American public was eager to buy, moral relativism. Public was smarter than that, and they would realize that if there's no such thing as moral truth, then there's no reason to think that people should be allowed to do anything they want. Mm-hmm. That meant that there was no good reason for stopping the powerful from preying on the vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So, the moral relativism that I can remember from my boyhood in the late 50s and early 60s has been largely abandoned by the left in favor of the adoption of highly moralistic language. And that's what you're pointing to here. Yeah. Death with dignity, compassion in dying, marriage equality, and so forth. Now, that was a smart move by the left because they're appealing now to the moral sentiments of the American people, but in a way that is manipulative, that is meant to deflect them away from the historic moral understanding of what dignity consisted in, what mm-hmm. equality meant, what true liberty as opposed to license is, what it means to be compassionate, and so forth. Now, Richard, it's very important, especially for our fellow believers, to understand this. We have to fight back. We have to fight back with arguments, mm-hmm. arguments, mm-hmm. not with violence, not with hatred, certainly, but in a Christian way, a biblical way, with love. But that means learning to make the arguments, learning to make the scientific arguments, learning to make mm-hmm. the moral and philosophical arguments. We can't simply quote Scripture to people who themselves do not treat Scripture as authoritative. Right. And of course, we're now entering into a domain of technology, new technologies, where we do not have explicit biblical teaching. We don't have an explicit biblical teaching on, for example, human cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer, and these kinds of things. There are some biblical principles that can be applied, but that takes logical reasoning to apply those basic principles to technologies that were unknown, of course, in the period in which the Bible was written and compiled. So we need to do the work of learning to make the arguments, and that's why I've written the book.
Yeah.
To help to arm people with the scientific information, with the philosophical arguments, with the logical arguments that will enable them to expose the fallacies that are at the heart of the case being made in favor of abortion through the whole 9 months of pregnancy, redefining marriage, transgender ideology, and all of these other things. And I hope that if people read the book, they will themselves feel much more confident at the water fountain or water cooler or with their friends or with people at church or wherever they are. They'll be a lot more confident that they know what they're talking about here. Now, we have, by the way, we have nothing to fear from rational argument. That's why I want rational argument.
Yeah,
I'm not going to beat people over the head with the Bible if they don't believe in the authority of the Bible. What they do purport to believe is in the authority of reason.
Yep.
Right? That's why they say we're going to make arguments, right?
Yep.
They purport to believe in the authority of reason. Fine. That's all I need. Let's go on the basis of who has the very best rational argument on the competing sides of any of these questions. I'm good with that. Let's do it.
Dr. George, I want to thank you for being that role model, for exemplifying Christian grace, excellence in thought, a principled biblical worldview when it comes to engaging the culture, but also thinking biblically when it comes to these issues of human dignity, marriage, religious freedom and conscience rights. You have been a great role model. Thank you for your leadership and the example you've set for many of us. The book is called Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, Law and Morality in Our Cultural Moment. You can find it at any of your favorite bookstores. Of course, it is on Amazon as well. Dr. George, thank you once again for joining the Come With Matters. May God bless you and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you again.